It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Coplin. Featuring stimulating, in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Coplin.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, featuring thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street on a wide variety of different subjects that affect us all, both locally and globally. And for this, the arts hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. The show combines a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways that we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts there of all past shows. We've had some wonderful guests and some very thought-provoking topics. And you can also connect with me on social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, if you so wish. So that's itsaquestionofbalance.com, the website. And on the homepage, there are tabs at the top for guests and topics, which make it easy to browse and choose the podcast that you want. So I encourage you to head over there and check that out. Well, this week as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing author Molly Prentice. Molly was born and raised in Santa Cruz, California, but can now be found living and writing in Brooklyn, New York. She's written fiction, poems, and essays. Her work appearing in Hobart, 14 Hills, HTML Giant, Mudluscious, and Le Petit Zine, among others. Molly was a writer in residence at Workspace at the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council and at the Blue Mountain Center, and was chosen as an Emerging Writer Fellow by the Aspen Writers Foundation. She holds an MFA in Creative Writing from the California College of the Arts in San Francisco. And Molly's first novel, Tuesday Nights in 1980, is just coming out and is published by the Simon & Schuster imprint Scout Press, which is a new literary imprint dedicated to publishing modern conversation-starting novelists whose books will stand the test of time. Shelf Awareness states of Molly's first novel, Tuesday Nights in 1980, is a sweepingly large and profound story about art, love, and actualization, cleanly and beautifully composed. A poetic novel of ambitiously profound considerations, a large-scale drama in a series of small, perfectly rendered moments. Well, welcome to the show, Molly.
Thank you so much, Ruth. It's great to be here.
Well, your novel, Tuesday Nights in 1980, is set in the creative art world of New York. I'm wondering whether you can remember the first piece of art that had an effect on you, whether it was a painting, a piece of writing, or something else, a film, where you realized the potential of art to affect us on a profound level rather than simply entertain us.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so many pieces of art have had that effect on me over the years. I would have to say my first brush with that was being read children's books by my mother. Mm. And I think some of my favorites that stand out right now, just thinking about it, I remember this book called The Lupin Lady. Have you heard of it?
No. Interesting. It's
this wonderful little book about this woman who spreads these lupin seeds across these green grassy hills. And it was so evocative in its images and in the writing. And I just remembered it totally transporting me to these gorgeous hillsides with wildflowers. And the way that the wildflowers were painted, these lupins were just these tiny dots of paint. Mm. And I remembered having this sort of realization at this tiny age that these tiny marks could evoke the idea of a flower. Mm. And it was so beautiful to me. And I think that's sort of the first moment where I sort of thought about how marks or gestures could create an image and sort of transport you somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a lot of children's books that had that same sort of effect on me. It moved into books that were just words, like trying to think, but like Little House on the Prairie, those Laura Ingalls Wilder books.
Mm, yeah.
Those sort of those just could totally transport you to these this like homesteading life where with these log cabins and the little girls in calico dresses and ribbons in their hair and drying venison on outside in the air. And basically, once I saw how words could do that same thing as images too, I started getting really interested in being transported by words. And so I think those early experiences with books really informed who I am as a writer and sort of the magic of what writing and art can do.
Yeah. And also, as you say, that connection between visual imagery in our mind and transporting us into a different experience through words. Yes. Without any visuals as well.
Yes, totally. I mean, that's a huge thing that I'm interested in with writing, and what I try to do in the book that I wrote is how do you capture visual images and art with just words? And it's a really tricky thing to do, but I think when you can achieve it, it's so exciting. And when you can bring things to life and make them colorful with just words is, I think, pretty exciting.
Yeah, and also because I think you're entering into a collaboration with the reader, because you are,
yes,
starting a process that they finish, and that can be, yes, different for each person too, can't it?
Definitely, yeah. I think that's what's so interesting, having people read the book or read anything that you write, is they come back to it with their own information. They have new information for you, you know, like their own experience reading it. And that's been really exciting. Everyone sort of layers their own stories on top of it. So that's always exciting to hear, too.
Yeah, absolutely. You said that your mother had read you books. Did you grow up in a creative environment, would you say?
Yes, I definitely did. That's a definitive yes. I grew up in an interesting situation in La Selva Beach, which is just south of California, in a sort of a communal living situation. So there were three families that lived on the same 10-acre plot of land, and we had dinner together every night, and a lot of the members of the community are creative individuals. I mean, everyone is in their own way. So I was really informed by a lot of different adults growing up, which I think really contributed to my sort of life vision and creative vision. And especially my parents are both extremely creative people. My father is a painter and sort of color genius and a designer, and my mother is a radio producer. Mm-hmm. and a storyteller, and she's a fabulous storyteller. And both of them, not only did their work influence me and the way they saw things, but also the way they lived their life. Mm-hmm. And I saw growing up that that it's possible and beautiful to sort of forge a life, forge your own life and forge your own path. And I think that always inspired me. I mean, I just always throughout my whole life wanted to follow my own creative vision, and they supported that in this amazing way. And same with all my siblings too, who are all creative humans as well. So I had a very supportive and creative childhood and upbringing.
I'm wondering if you remember the first thing that you wrote yourself that impressed you as a piece of writing, where you thought, oh, you know, I might have something here.
I wrote when I was in college, in my undergraduate degree, I took a writing class sort of on a whim, and I wasn't majoring in writing. I was doing global studies and studying Italian. And then I took this writing class my senior year on a whim, and I remember writing this piece about braces, getting braces as a child. I made myself laugh with it, and I just had so much fun writing about it. I had such terrible experiences with braces.
Oh, no.
And for some reason, writing about it transformed it for me, and it made it funny. And I was able to sort of, tap into the humor of sort of a traumatic experience. And I thought that was really exciting. And it was also the first time that it sort of felt natural to me. I had, you know, before then I had been doing, you write all of your school papers, you turn in your 5-paragraph essays. And in this writing class, it was the first time where I thought, writing could be something different. I could just use my own voice and I could just do it like I was talking to a friend, or make a joke that I would make to a friend, or, be as wild as I want with my imagery, or be as conversational as I want with my voice. And so that class really opened up sort of the floodgates for me. And then when I really started writing seriously, was not until a few years later when I went traveling with my sister in Central and South America, and I started writing seriously mostly because I had nothing else to do. there was so much to do. We were traveling, but at the same time, there's so much downtime and loneliness, and that there was so much space to fill.
And so
writing sort of became my companion. And I realized when I was putting all the stories I was seeing on my travels down somewhere, and when I was using my spare time to write, I started not feeling lonely anymore. Like it was just this amazing feeling of always having somewhere to put my thoughts and someone to communicate with, even though I wasn't communicating with anyone besides myself.
Right.
So I really started writing stories at that point, and toward the end of our trip, which was about almost a year, 8 months long or something, is when I applied to graduate school, and that's when I decided to really pursue writing with as a serious mission in my life.
Right. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Well, if you just joined us, I'm talking to my guest from the arts this week, Molly Prentice, about her writing career and also her new novel that's coming out Tuesday nights in 1980. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com. It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Did you know about the Santa Cruz Art League on Broadway in Santa Cruz? Founded in 1919, it's 96 years young and provides a wonderful gallery space for local and national artists. It's a great place to view art with 14 shows a year, and also to gain support if you're an artist yourself. There are art classes and weekend workshops, many taught by open studio artists. If you become a member, you receive a newsletter, discounts on classes, gifts and exhibit entries, images of your art on the Art League website, and guaranteed participation in the annual members show. It's also a great place to meet artists. Visit the Santa Cruz Art League at 562 Broadway or the website at scal.org. That's scal.org.
I'm Casey, and I'm a second-generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore, and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. It's a question of balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Molly Prentice. And I wanted to let you know, we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz there in the break that Molly is going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 14th of April at 7 p.m. She's going to be talking about her new book, Tuesday Nights in 1980, and answering questions. So you can go along and meet her there in person. That's the 14th of April at 7 p.m. And also, if you want any information about Molly, you can go to her website, mollyprentice.com. That's mollyprentiss.com. Well, before the break, Molly, you were mentioning how you went into a graduate program for writing. You have an MFA in creative writing from the California College of the Arts. Not all published writers have studied writing at university. What are the advantages, do you think, of studying writing at university rather than studying literature, which is perhaps more what writers in the past did, formally or informally?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's really different for every writer. The reasons that I really needed and benefited from studying at CCA were, well, twofold. One is that it basically made me commit to this being a thing that I was pursuing in my life, both with, you know, it's a monetary commitment, but also it's time and space. It's 2 years where you're focusing solely on learning the craft of writing and studying writing and studying other writers and learning from professors who are writers, and also seeing how those professors are creating their lives as writers, which is a hard thing to do. So seeing how people make it work, really those 2 years informed me sort of not only on, you know, how to develop a character or how to make your plot and your story work. That was all sort of almost secondary. It was more to me the commitment to making my life as a writer and witnessing how that's done. So that was really important to me. But also it was this amazing, I mean, it basically gave me this, it kind of makes it sound too small, but it gave me a reading list. Like, I had these professors who, you know, are so well-read and such amazing writers themselves. And when they give you their list of favorite books to read and you're reading a book a week for the whole semester, kind of curated by these great thinkers, I read books that I never would have read if I was just kind of studying on my own, or even if I was in a literature program where you're maybe studying more of one genre of literature or like the classics or something. So for me, it really was an eye-opener in so many ways. It gave me access to so many tools that I wouldn't have had. Since I went to school at an art school, I was able to sort of cross-pollinate with taking art classes as well, which was really important to me. And not only me taking the classes, but a lot of my friends at school were visual artists. So that was really amazing too, because there was this sort of back and forth of ideas, this exchange of ideas that wasn't only in one medium. So that, I think, really informed my book, which has so much to do with visual art, and also just informed my way of thinking and sort of how I see things. To me, it was a really special experience.
Can you give listeners a short synopsis of Tuesday Nights in 1980 without giving too much away?
Sure. My publicist and I always talk about how it's a really hard book to do a short synopsis of.
We could do a longer one if you want. Just don't give too much away.
What happens in the book? It centers around three main characters. One is Raul, who is from Argentina, and who flees Argentina sort of just at the cusp of the dirty war in Argentina. And he comes to New York and is trying to make it as a painter in the big city. And then there is Lucy, who comes from Idaho, and she's just arrived in New York, sort of naive and wide-eyed, and looking around at the city and being so excited by it, and especially infatuated with artists. And she ends up sort of being Raul's muse, and they fall in love. And then the third main character is James, who is an art critic for the New York Times. And he is a special art critic because he has synesthesia, which is this cognitive condition that the pathways in your brain are sort of swapped when it comes to your senses. So basically, like, if you see a certain color, you could hear a certain sound, or if you taste something, you might also see something, or vice versa. It has a bunch of different ways it can manifest in each person with the condition. But so he has this ability to sort of add this other layer of sensation on top of every piece of art that he looks at. And so he's this sort of almost magical art critic who is sort of rising to fame for that reason. And these three characters sort of bump into each other in all of these wild ways, and have their various tragedies and downfalls and upswings, and that's the main gist of the book.
Yeah. The press release for the book states, "What do you do when the one thing that defines you is taken away? This is the question at the heart of Molly Prentice's affecting and absorbing debut novel." Did this question drive your process, or did this question come out of the characters and story as they evolved?
It came out of the characters and the story. I did a workshop with Meg Wolitzer at one point. I went to a program in Aspen and worked with her for a week. And she, at the onset of the class, one of the things she said was, "If you don't have a central question of your book, it's not worth writing." And so I was so stressed out about this, and I labored over, what is the question? This is before my book was done. I was thinking, what is my book about? Like, what is the question? What is the question? And so I really dug deep into what is the driving force behind each of these characters? So what is their sort of their problem, or their what changes over the course of them in this book? And I realized, after thinking about it for quite a long time, many months after I worked with Meg Wolitzer, that each of them was sort of not robbed, but they lose at some point during the book this thing that had come to that they defined themselves by. So it definitely came during the process of evolving the book, and it wasn't the driving force of it.
Each character suffers a personal trauma that affects their life. You know, one could say it's like a lot of bad luck. What motivated you to put your characters through this sort of bad luck, if you like?
Well, I sort of always think about what's like the worst possible thing that could happen to someone.
As one does.
Yeah, it's sort of where my brain goes. I often think about, especially I think that way in, with people related to people that have gifts, like I worry about them losing those gifts. Like I think about it a lot with like sport, people that play sports or famous athletes, like, you know, at what point in their career do they get an injury or they're just too old to do that sport anymore? Like it would always make me so upset to think of gymnasts who like couldn't compete after age 18 or something, you know? But this thing that this gift you have that defines you and what happened, what is the trajectory of that gift? And I think there's inevitably in every single person with talent or ambition or, you know, pursuing something specific, I think there's always a moment where that has to kind of break or change or evolve. And that's really interesting to me and scary. I think a lot of the reasons I put my characters through these, you know, through these crazy scenarios where they lose everything is sort of out of fear of that same thing. You know, it's my own fears of, you know, losing my ability to write or to speak or, you know, to see. I think I always go to those sort of dark places. And so giving them to my characters was sort of a way of feeling them out and following them to their various ends.
Yeah. It also seems to be considering being defined by what you do rather than who you are, perhaps at your core, in your being. Is that something that you wanted people to think about reading the book? That how we define ourselves and what we define ourselves by?
Definitely. I mean, I think these characters are existing in New York City, which I think is so much a place that defines you by what you do. And that's such an interesting thing to be around and kind of learn how to define yourself in the city. And it's one of those things where, you know, you really start questioning everything if you're not pursuing, you know, something that's interesting or succeeding at your, you know, at your art or all of these things. And I think it's something that a lot of my friends and I talk about. It's, I mean, the first thing people ask you often is, what do you do? Or in many of the circles I run in, it's like, what kind of art do you make? Or what's your practice? Or, you know, and so I think that is sort of the first thing that you define yourself by here. And I do, it does worry me sometimes, you know, I think that, I don't think that is completely real. And I think that you can get caught up in it in New York. And I often think about leaving for that very reason.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting to hear you say that. Cause I don't know New York at all, but I often think the same thing as what you're saying about Los Angeles, about Hollywood. You know, there's a similar sort of, what do you do? And, you know, what are you doing with it?
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of pressure to be defined by what you're doing rather than who you are, unless you keep a very strong sense of yourself. And that's quite challenging, I think.
It really is.
Yeah.
And I think in many ways it's, you know, it's defensive. It's sort of a defensive way to live, to be, you know, completely defined by what you do, because that's actually sort of an exterior. And I think in New York, you're always so busy and so working in that exterior mode that it's easy to, like, you know, lose track of or not deal with the other part, which is the more internal part.
Because also with the external, I mean, as you show in your novel, a large part of that is beyond our control, how we respond to it. We can choose, but, you know, if you're being defined by what you do, a large part of that is not in your control, you know, what you succeed at to some degree. Would you agree?
Very true.
Yeah. New York looms large in the novel, almost as a character as well as a setting, and it seems people are often divided into those who love cities or hate cities with not a lot in between. And you grew up in a place very different to New York. What was the attraction for you to move to the city and also to make it such a strong focus of the book?
Yeah, it's really crazy when I think about it that I live here. because I grew up in a place that was really remote and so beautiful, and I really miss it, and I love it so much. And I think part of my attraction to the city, well, I'm trying to think of exactly what it was, but I did have this, I think part of it was from growing up in a communal living situation where there were always, even though we were out kind of in a remote area, there were always people around. And I sort of developed like a fear of being kind of isolated or alone because there were always people around. And I think the sort of next best thing is to have this, the sort of communal energy that New York provides, sort of wherever you walk. To me, it sort of feels like, even though maybe this is the opposite of what it is, it sort of feels safe because everyone's around you all the time.
Right, yeah.
And also I was really attracted. I mean, as I said before, my family is a very artistic family, and you know, we were the kind of family who went on, like, if we were going to go on vacation, we wouldn't go to the beach. We would go to like museums and like cultural institutions and, you know, do the walking tours with the headphones and stuff. And so I feel like it was always sort of important to me to be around a cultural center, a place where I could go see as much art as I wanted, or see music, or, you know, be around other people that are making things that are interesting to me, and having certain kinds of conversations. So I think that all of those things, when I first sort of visited New York to see if I wanted to move here, and I just was sort of swept up by it and thought, you know, the energy is so attractive in this one way. And
yeah,
it's scary too. It's also dismal, as you see in my book. It's like dismal and depressing and dirty and, you know, all of the things that New York can be when you first move here. But it also has this really powerful energy that I haven't found anywhere else. And I keep living here despite how hard it is sometimes. So.
Well, good for you. Staying with the creativity there. If you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, author Molly Prentice, whose new novel, Tuesday Nights in 1980, is coming out very soon. We're going to go to a break now, but stay with us. We'll be back for more conversation after these messages.
Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore and have been located in the heart of downtown Santa Cruz for over 47 years.
Ciao. I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, Molly Prentice, whose new novel, Tuesday Nights in 1980, is coming out very soon. And just to remind you again, if you want to find out more information about Molly, you can go to her website, mollyprentice.com. That's mollyprentice.com. And also wanted to let you know that she will be, if you're a local, she'll be at Bookshop Santa Cruz on the 14th of April at 7 p.m. talking about her new book, so you can meet her in person then. It's often said that everyone has one novel in them, Molly, i.e. their own life story. I'm wondering how much or little of Tuesday Nights in 1980 would you say reflects aspects of your own life?
My own life. In some ways, a lot, and in some ways, not at all. The story is, none of the story is my story. But when my dad read it, he said, I could see all of us in it. And I was sort of taken aback by that, because I definitely wasn't thinking of anyone from my own life when I was writing these characters. But I think that a lot of the sensibility that I was raised with and that my family has and that I've grown to have is in there. And there's some of the coming to New York story. Lucy, who is the young woman who comes to New York when she's 22 from a small town in Idaho, I definitely included some bits that felt exactly like my getting to New York story. Mm. So that was in there a little bit, but mostly, the story is definitely not my story. But the sensibility is mine.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I did wonder about Lucy, because I found myself underlining quite a lot of things in that part where there's a section where, you know, it begins her story. There's some sort of nuggets, you know, that sort of stand out, and I was thinking, oh, I wonder if that is some of your own voice, you know, coming
yeah.
through her.
Yeah, definitely. She at one point, she on her first day in New York, she paints the walls in her new bedroom like a yellow color in order to sort of like feel okay about her depressing tiny New York apartment, and that's exactly what I did. I got in on a red eye flight at 7 a.m. and immediately called my mom and burst into tears and was like, what am I doing here? And then she was like, you know, it's okay, just take control of your situation. And so I went, as soon as the paint store opened, I went and walked down to the paint store and bought Scotch yellow paint and painted my walls.
So
that nugget is mine.
I'm just looking here at some of the things underlined. Like, Lucy didn't want to have any one story. She wanted a whole life made out of stories, momentum, propulsion, characters, change. And here's another bit. Fear for not what might be in store, but for what might not be, that your bravery, which looks so big in your hometown, would not amount to anything, that New York City would not deliver on its promise for something grand, glamorous, unknown, and unknowable. Yeah. I know.
Sounds this one. Good when you read it.
And then this, I like this one. A girl in a room full of other girls just like her who have come here to tunnel down into their own dark parts and find the light. So those were some examples of what I read, thinking, I wonder if some of that it reflects Molly's journey in New York.
it definitely does. I also think it's sort of, from what I've heard and sort of the reaction that I've gotten from a lot of people, both my age and much older than me, is that it's sort of a similar experience. It's a common experience for coming to New York. It's really cool because a lot of people have sort of come to me and said, like, oh, I remember when I first moved there and there were cockroaches everywhere and I shared a room with two other girls and da da da. And there's this common getting to New York and things feel crazy and you wonder why you're there. And it's sort of great though, because it's this feeling between New Yorkers, I think, that that they're all sort of in it together because they've gone through these things.
Right.
So there's this sort of like spirit about it that I like.
Yes, yeah. Your book publisher, Scout, says that they aim to publish conversation-starting novelists. I'm wondering, what kind of conversations would you hope that Tuesday Nights in 1980 is going to start?
I hope good ones. I don't know. That's a really hard question. I think...
I guess we touched on it a bit earlier in terms of talking about how people define themselves. I mean, that is one of the strong themes of the book, definitely. And how you recover if that definition of yourself is removed.
Yes, definitely. I think that is a big conversation to come out of it. I think... I would like... Even though it's a really small part of the book, the Argentina sections, I would like people to be curious about that. And although it doesn't illuminate a lot about it in the book, I think it sort of provokes interest in what actually was happening in Argentina during that time. And judging from even just among my friends or people I know here, like, Those sorts of large scale political tragedies are just not really addressed. That was sort of shut out of our media at the time, and even people don't know about it.
Yeah.
And so I do hope that people are interested and intrigued by that.
Why did you include that when it, as you say, it's a sort of backdrop in certain parts of the novel, but it's not a main part. What made you want to include that?
When I was in graduate school, I had taken this really amazing enlightening class with this woman, Claudia Bernardi, who's from Argentina, and she the class was called The Violent Task of Remembering, and it focused on different populations throughout Central and South America that had had these massive disappearances or like mass killings or kidnappings. But also focused on how art was made out of those experiences, or how people began to talk about those experiences in a way that was like, an artistic manifestation of those things. So she presented all of this artwork that had to do with the disappearances. So that became really interesting to me, just as its own topic, but also as I was learning it as I was writing about sort of the same time period happening in New York. And it was just sort of mind-boggling to me that, of course, there are always like really vastly different experiences happening in different places all over the world at the same time. But just as I was sort of like diving into this eccentric, exciting moment in, you know, New York, the art scene, and then I was also thinking about that at the same moment there were, you know, if you were, it was a lot of the sort of, you know, quote unquote radical thinkers or artists or, you know, intellectuals or writers who were the ones that were being captured and detained and eventually killed in Argentina. And I think that sort of stifling could have been happening somewhere else so close.
Yeah.
While in New York, it was sort of the opposite, where there was this just like massive expression happening.
Yeah. I mean, it does speak to the power of art, sadly, that when you have totalitarian regimes, that's one of the first things that they do is clamp down on artists. I think in Cambodia, something like 90% of the artists were killed. So, you know, subsequently, they're having to try and regenerate that, the whole art scene was an enormous task. So it puts in context as well, I think, and this is partly what you're saying, I think, you know, there's a struggle always in art. What are we saying? What does it mean? You know, where is its place? Mm-hmm. But when you have a context of something so dire as people being tortured and disappeared and things like that, it throws a different light on everything somehow, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think it really does.
Yeah. Entire civilizations once founded every aspect of their culture upon the arts because they believed the arts could affect change upon the individual and society and even upon matter itself. Confucius, for instance, believed the arts possessed tremendous power for good or evil, and yet today the arts are frequently more about entertainment, money and sensation than affecting personal or societal change. In particular, shock and sensationalism, you know, seem to be at the fore. Your novel is set in the vibrant art world of New York in 1980, which to some degree is grappling with this tension about the meaning and place of art. I'm wondering what you see as the place for art today, and is this something you want readers to think about on reading the novel, even though it's set in the past?
Of course, the book takes place sort of on this on the brink of, I guess, the quote-unquote commercialization of the downtown art scene and like New York art in general. And I think that sort of pinnacle or like that moment where things are about to tip or shift is really interesting to me because it's interesting what happens, I think, to artwork when money gets introduced.
Mm.
I think part of what I was so attracted to writing about, it was like artists making art in these kind of communities when the money hadn't showed up yet.
Yes.
And what that looks like versus what it starts to look like when there is this vision that success or money or fame could just be right around the corner, or that, you know, that it's being given to you in some way. And how does that shift your mentality, and how does that change the work?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that it's an interesting topic, and I think it always is happening. I mean, it's not like happened in the 80s. I mean,
yeah,
it's happening to a lot of my friends right now. I have a friend who's a painter who, you know, he's been painting for 15 years, and he's a wonderful painter, but he just recently, you know, got picked up by this major gallery and has sold out every show for the last 6 months, and he's, like, blowing up. And so he is really grappling with, you know, how does this change his life? You know, first, so he quit his day job, which is another whole issue, like artists with day jobs, which I could talk about forever, but
yes, yeah.
His primary, his primary mode of income and also like, so his livelihood and his daily life is all taken up by the art. And how does that change it from being this side passion that, you know, you're carving out this space for in your life versus when it becomes your main source of income and how you fill your hours every day. And I think I think it's just really interesting that moment in an artist's life. And I think I wrote about that in the book, and I'm also thinking about it even in my own life and seeing my friends think about it. So, I don't know if that really answers your question.
I mean, I think it's interesting to think about what validates art, and I think increasingly in our society it has become more about money. I mean, but there is this push-pull, because obviously as an artist what you want to do is communicate your art, whatever form it is in. I mean, art is communication. Until it's sort of received by people, it's not complete in a way. So you need to get it out there, ideally. And yet, is what become successful always the best art? You know, that's the question. And
big question.
Yeah, you know, so it is, it's a difficult place to be in, I think. You know, what does validate art, and when you are validated, what does it mean and how does it affect you? We're coming towards the end of the show. I just wanted to ask you, as a final question, you're in that position now that all aspiring writers hope to be in when you're on the brink of your first novel being published. I'm wondering what that feels like.
It feels both really exciting and really terrifying. it's mostly exciting. It's interesting because it's such a long process to get from when you sell the book to when it comes out. So it's almost been a year and a half where I've been in this sort of waiting game where you know it's coming out, you know it's coming out, you know it's coming out, and now it's down to these final couple weeks. And it definitely feels intense, but it also is like, okay, it's been a long time coming. And, you know, I worked on the novel for close to 7 years, so I feel it feels really exciting. But I'm also, you know, it's nerve-wracking to have a thing that you've put so much of your time and yourself into being out there sort of for the public to judge and talk about.
I suppose it speaks to that theme we were talking about of how you define yourself, you know, whether by what you do or who you are. So hopefully the creation of the novel itself can stand alone no matter what, you know, happens how it's received.
I'm going to let it be its own entity, and I'll be separate from it now.
Well, obviously, so far it's had pre-reviews, you know, professional reviews of it have been very encouraging. So I'm sure
I'm really thankful for it.
I'm sure it's going to do well. So I wish you all the very best with your book tour. And thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Ruth. It was great talking to you.
So that was Molly Prentice, who got her new book, Tuesday Nights in 1980, coming out very soon. And just to remind you again, she's going to be at Bookshop Santa Cruz. So you can go and see her there if you're local to Santa Cruz. That's 14th of April at 7 p.m. And just to remind you, you can visit the website, itsaquestionofbalance.com, to get more information about the show. And if you enjoy this interview, tell your friends about it, and they can hear the podcast by going to the website. I hope you have a good week, and I'll see you next time.